even existing with the people that we don't don't agree with.
Yeah, we are out of time, and so just I don't even know how to wrap up. There's so much to chew on.
Thank you, Michael.
There is just so much to chew on. Michael Mead, thank you very much for joining us again. For folks wanting to find out more about Michael's work, you can find it at mosaicvoices.org. Michael, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Audie. Good luck to both you and everybody listening.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for your work. And with that, we make way now for One Land, Many Voices, coming right up. Continue to listen to KBOO. We'll be back next week.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock a.m. And as promised, One Land, Many Voices is coming right up right after these important announcements, so stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the August Wilson Monologue Competition Regional Finals on Monday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at the Newmark Theater in Portland. 12 Portland area high school students will perform monologues from August Wilson's 10-play American Century Cycle, and two will be selected to go to the national competition. There will also be a DJ spinning blues, jazz, R&B, and hip-hop. Again, that's the August Wilson Monologue Competition Regional Finals on Monday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at the Newmark Theater, 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Stand Together is a day of workshops for people new to social and political action and for those upgrading their skills. Sessions include digital security, photography for action, strategic planning, nonviolent direct action, legal basics, know your rights, and more. Again, that's Stand Together, a day of action workshop, Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitary Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
All right, you guys, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. You can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org. More than 4,000 interviews now, going back to 2003, scotthorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right. So, introducing our friend Ramsey Baruth. RamseyBaruth.net is one website. Palestine Chronicle. .com is the other. His latest book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story. And we run quite a bit of what he writes, at least, at antiwar.com as well, original.antiwar.com/Ramsey-Baruth. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me again.
Very happy to have you here. Always interested in talking about Israel-Palestine issues with you. And, well, I guess for start here, so the article is Enough Fear Mongering, only one democratic state is possible in Palestine and Israel. And this is, I guess, basically, you know, more or less your reaction to John Kerry's big way too little too late speech about how it would be in the best interests of the Israelis, never mind the Americans, if the Israelis would give up the West Bank and Gaza Strip to be an independent Palestinian state like in the deal. And you're arguing here that no such thing. So I wanted to bring up one more thing before I turn it over to you here, because John Kerry's John Kerry, right? So who cares what that idiot says? But we run at antiwar.com a lot. I do. Yuri Avnery, who, as I'm sure you're aware, is an Israeli leftist and peacenik. He fought in the 1948 war, but he's been pushing for a two-state solution ever since. Maybe there's a lesson in futility there. But he strongly believes in peace. He strongly believes in the rights and dignity of the people of Palestine. He wants them to have independence and safety. And he thinks it's got to be two states. He says it's the only game in town. And a one-state solution, you know, man, okay, I understand how you feel about it and everything, but in practice, my God, it would be a worse nightmare than even having a fake rump demilitarized two states. Maybe it'd even be worse than this peace process and this and the second state that never comes. So it's not just John Kerry, the fool who may be easy for our listeners to dismiss, but Yuri Avnery, he seems to have a pretty good case. He seems to have thought about this pretty well. And I guess he seems to think that if the Israeli Jewish population had to choose between equal rights for everybody or another Nakba, at that point, forced to choose, that it would be another Nakba before they would actually allow there to be a one-state solution and equal rights for everyone between the river and the sea. So, go ahead, sir, and tell me how you answer to that.
Well, to begin with, I do not think that John Kerry is an idiot. I think that he knows very well the nature of the game that his the Obama administration has been playing, which is, you know, kind of keeping the pro-Israel camp at bay, pacifying them at any cost to keep things moving forward, because they just don't, they can't afford confronting the Congress. And as we know, that the Congress is more Israeli than American, sadly. And they waited until the last few weeks in the Obama administration to really show a little bit of gutso, a little bit of integrity. That's when they did not veto the UN resolution 2334 condemning Israeli settlements. They supported the Paris Peace Conference yesterday, and so forth. But again, really, is too little, too late. He understands fully the nature of the game. Sadly, though, whenever criticism of the Israeli settlements are being presented, the context is not, listen, this is really a violation of human rights. It constitutes war crimes. You can't be transferring your population into an occupied territories. You are violating the Fourth Geneva Convention. If you don't cease and desist, we are going to infuse various articles in international law and punish you for it, as any other country experiences in these situations. In the case of Israel, you are hurting yourself. And if you don't stop, you are going to hurt yourself even more. Screw the Palestinians, you know, those people who have been suffering for 70 years. They are not really the main point of concern here. It is Israel's well-being. It's Israel's Jewish identity that matters. It's Israel this, Israel's that. That's what really I found infuriating as a Palestinian, not just as a Palestinian writer, but just as your everyday Palestinian. It's just you never really feel like your well-being, your concern, your collective rights as a nation is ever really paramount to anybody, anywhere in this debate, sadly. Also sadly, I think Yuri Avnery is coming from the same point of view. Don't forget that Yuri fought in the 1948 war. And he fought as part of a group that we as Palestinians consider, you know, Zionist terrorist militia. And when you read Yuri's writing about that particular generation, He looks back at those days in this kind of emotive, reminiscing nature. I mean, his writing about it's not, we are ashamed of what we have done, people. You know, don't forget our country has been based on ethnic cleansing. Israel would have not existed if it were not for the fact that Palestinians were, you know, were kicked out of the country. No, he really looks back at those days as days of honor and greatness for Israel. And that's why many of us Palestinians, even though I am in touch with Yuri once in a while, but we have a serious problem with the foundation of his intellect, which is the idea that the past was okay, and we don't need to talk about it. Let's just talk about the 1967 borders. For me, the 1967 borders is just an outcome of the original sin that took place in 1948. That's the Nakba. The 1967 border and the 1967 war is not the origins of the problem. The genesis of all of this is 1948, and Yuri doesn't want to talk about it. For Yuri and many in the Israeli left, they still talk about, Palestinian people, that we need to somehow remedy their problem. They don't address us as a nation that has been wronged throughout history. And he still feels that the Jewish identity of Israel is the central piece of any future solution to the conflict, which, again, we have a serious problem with it. Because even if we are to say that the two-state solution, Scott, is still practicable for any reason, which is not at all, but if we are to accept that premise, that a two-state solution is still possible, how do you count for the 1.5 million Arabs, hundreds of thousands of Jews and Bedouins and Christians who are still living in Israel and will continue supposedly living in that Israel under the auspices of a Jewish state where Jews have greater rights than everybody else? So we haven't yet still addressed the fundamental problem and the fundamental error in Zionist thinking. That will not even solve the problem then. This is why we are saying, for all intents and purposes and for all practical reasons, and to really address the issue from its very, very roots, the fact is, between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, right now, live two people of different backgrounds and ethnicities and religions. And they are coexisting. They are not tolerating one another, but they are coexisting. Palestinians are separated by checkpoints and settlements dotting the Palestinian landscape, and two sets of laws, one that prefers one over the other, exist. And we need to change that. We don't need to change the reality. They think it's impractical. We think it's insane to think of any other path but this. Because if you and I, Scott, are already living in the same neighborhood, but you are receiving certain privileges and I'm denied these privileges, I am advocating that you and I to be treated as equal, instead of building a wall between me and you, separating me from my school and my farm and my people living on your side of the neighborhood. That doesn't make any sense. So Yuri and the others in the Israeli left, they really need to get over this complex. We are living in the 21st century now, and we do not separate people based on ethnicities anymore. In this country, we call it racism. In Israel, let's call it racism as well.
Yeah. Well, it really does sound like almost a question of, boy, if you try to desegregate Mississippi now, with the Klan as powerful as it is now, the backlash is going to be so bad that really maybe they're better off pushing for a separate little rump mini state for blacks in Mississippi, because boy, oh boy, can you imagine what the whites will do if they're forced to share power? And that argument finally lost out in this country.
Precisely, Scott. And what a lot of people just don't understand is that this is a very, very similar argument, if not even an identical one. In fact, it's even worse in a sense, because we are the original inhabitants of that land. We are the natives of that land. So not only are you denying us equal rights, you are denying our very existence and our roots. Because if a Palestinian leadership is compromising enough to come and say, yes, we do acknowledge Israel as a country for the Jews, it's a Jewish state. Okay, fair enough. But you know what this does to the Palestinian narrative? It means that my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my ancestors had absolutely no rights. We were just passers-by in history. We are nomads. We don't belong to that land. So it's our very identity is being shattered by making. So this is not just about coexistence and about the future, but it's also about the past.
All right, now here's the thing, though, too. Right is right and everything, but politics is politics. And in politics, the Palestinian Authority, way back in 1988, said, hey, man, a fait accompli is a fait accompli. You guys won. You stole a bunch of the land and you built on it and you own it now. And we'll accept, I guess it's 22%, whatever it is, and we'll go ahead and recognize the state of Israel. I've even seen, a leader of Hamas on the Charlie Rose show on PBS say, look, if you'll end the occupations and make a peace deal recognizing a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank, then we will recognize Israel as part of that deal. So it's not quite Arafat in 88, but it's, yes, we absolutely intend to do that as soon as you'll deal with us. And so from the politics point of view, it sounds like what you're saying is, what was good enough for Arafat and now even for Hamas is still not good enough for you, which seems to play into the hands of the Likudniks who say, see, what they want to do is completely destroy Israel altogether and make it, you know, Israelstein or something like that, where heaven forbid the Palestinians might even one day have a majority vote and rule the place and make it no longer Israel at all, which is no different than invading the place and pushing all the Jews into the sea. That would be their argument. So are you actually in real life, no matter how right you might be about morality, playing into their hands and making matters worse?
That's an excellent point, Scott. And I think the key to the answer is what you mentioned, 1988. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, or the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, acknowledged Israel's right to exist as a state in 1988. But what happened since then is really what changes the nature of the debate altogether. Don't forget that our greatest intellectual of all times, Edward Said, the late Edward Said, had also at one point in his career, in his writing, acknowledged and supported the idea of a two-state solution. And if you look at my articles of 20 years ago, I also supported the two-state solution. Not because we were, you know, morally blind then. No, to the contrary, we were using the same gauge of morality and values and ethics. But what happened after 1988, in 5 years after that date, the Oslo Peace Accords was signed. And according to the Oslo Peace Accord of 1993, the final status negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel, thus a Palestinian state, would be established 5 years from that date. In other words, by now, we should have had a Palestinian state that has been happening for about 20 years. Not only that did not happen, but some numbers have changed so dramatically. The number of settlers, the number of illegal Jewish settlers in the West Bank has doubled or tripled since then. It has actually doubled in the last 10 years alone. The amount of land that was confiscated from that supposed Palestinian state has actually tripled since then. Jerusalem, that was supposed to be our capital, has been completely annexed and cut off from the rest of the West Bank. Not just that, the Israelis are now saying, not only I'm not going to even give you a two, they are saying that we do not believe in the two-state idea anymore. So they brought three times as much of their population into this Palestinian state. Our land has shrunk so much and is sliced up like Swiss cheese, with Jewish-only roads, Jewish-only settlements. Our capital is completely taken, and this is it. Now, for me to come and, you know, just promote the two-state idea, I would be the ridiculous one at this point. I am not on the margins. In fact, just last month, a Palestinian poll was published by a very respected polling center in the West Bank that said 65% of Palestinians are now saying the two-state state idea is not workable, impractical, they don't want it anymore. They understand more than me and more than Mahmoud Abbas and more than all the intellectuals in their ivory towers that from their everyday routine and everyday life, that this is no longer permissible. It's just not going to happen.
Well, and even the major premise of Carrie's speech is that this is the last minute. Time is running out if this is going to be possible at all. And you're saying, oh, come on, even that is whistling past the graveyard here.
Exactly. And you know what? The idea, Scott, that the two-state solution is dead. If you go to Google and type two-state solution is dead, put it between quotes, you'll find that people have been saying this for about 15 years or so now. And they're not saying it because they are promoters of a one state. The same John Kerry narrative. Two states is dead. It's over. Our last chance, our last chance, our last chance. They've been saying this forever. My children are now teenagers in universities, and they have been saying this before they were even born. So the question is, how long are we going to promote and perpetuate this illusion instead of focusing on building coexistence now? Because that time that is being wasted, people are suffering, people are dying. That's the
question. All right, but now, so here we get back to the Mississippi example. And boy, is the Klan powerful here. Did I say Missouri the first time? I forget which state I'm picking on there, boys.
But Mississippi.
Yeah, Mississippi. So the deal is now, if, I don't know, Wonder Woman came and put a magic lasso to Netanyahu's head and make him give up the West Bank, make him go ahead and finish annexing the West Bank and make all the Palestinian citizens, then wouldn't there just immediately be a civil war? Isn't Israeli political society as right-wing as it has ever been at this point, where, as you say, even lip service to justice for Palestinians is now suspended? And, I mean, I don't know, how many million people live in the West Bank, and aren't they all disarmed? And wouldn't the policy at that point be to simply just, you know, do a Cherokee Trail of Tears and force march them into the Jordan River or into the Sinai Desert or some kind of thing and just take it? And it seems like what you're calling for makes perfect sense and all that, except for the people of Israel and especially their military and their national security state are never going to stand for it.
You know, I've already answered this question in my last article, Scott, because, you know, the John Kerry was talking about this doomsday scenario if a two-state solution is not possible. And my argument is, as far as we Palestinians are concerned, that doomsday scenario is already in effect. It's already happening. You know what happened in Gaza in the wars of 2008, 9, 2012, and 2014? Over 6,000 people were killed. Over 25,000 people were injured. The entire population was ethnically cleansed from one side to the other and back and forth. And you still have about 150,000 people who are homeless, right? The West Bank is militarily occupied. People are being killed every day. People are being ethnically cleansed from their land every day. So I'm not going to talk about a doomsday scenario or a possibility of this dark cloud that's going to happen in case, you know, if we continue to push for a one-state solution, because that is already in action. That's already in effect. I want to stop what is happening right now. I want to create a new reality. Okay, that allows us to stop the bloodletting that is already in effect. If we are living in a state, not necessarily a state of peace, Scott, but a state of relative tranquility, I would say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't push such radical ideas to upset this existing scenario. But the existing scenario is suffocating, is killing us. So this is what we need to deal with. The second thing is, if you want to use the Mississippi scenario, then okay, fine. Do you think just because African Americans would be terrified of the possibilities if they ask for equal rights, they should stop asking for equal rights? Isn't this what happened during the civil rights movement? I mean, they were asking for rights during a time that they were almost completely disempowered. But they mobilize and they fought and they fought, and the fight is going to carry on for God knows how long. It will not end anytime soon. For us, we have to start somewhere. But my feeling right now is that we are completely on the wrong path. We are entirely on the wrong path. We need to reorient ourselves. It's a marathon. It's very long. It's hard. It's painful. But we need a starting point. And the starting point is start thinking in terms of practical solutions that are actually the most rational at this point. is, you know, 60% of Israeli Jews are actually from Arab background. Did you know that? They are Mizrahis. They are Sephardim. They are, they call them the Spanish Jews. They are Arabs. They are from North Africa, from Morocco, from Yemen, from Iraq, from Syria. 60%. I mean, it's not like I am asking us to mix two elements that never mixed before. Arabs and Jews coexisted in the past, and the current Jewish race, actually, majority of it in Israel, are actually Arabs. Hmm. You know, I don't see why that would not be workable, because I can't get Bennett and Netanyahu and Levin and other radical right-wing Israelis to accept the fact that they are like the rest of us, that they are not particularly special, that they are not particularly chosen, that they are equal beings. And for me as Palestinian, I am making the compromise here because that's my ancestors' land. And I am saying, I want to share it with you. I don't want to live in a cage. I don't want my kids to be inferior for the rest of their lives. Let's talk about the possibility of finding room to coexist, share the water that you already taken from us without permission anyway, share the land that you're already stealing from us without permission anyway. Let's find a way. Let's just change the rules and the laws that would apply on us on equal basis. If they are going to react by start ethnically cleansing my people, well, they have been doing this for 70 years anyway. What difference is this going to make?
All right. Now, one solution that I've read of before, and I don't know if there are precedents for this. I think the article that I'm thinking of had cited some sort of historical precedents for what they call the binational state, where it would be one surrounding border, but two internal police forces that would, you know, basically have jurisdiction over their own populations, but not geographically designated, just based on, it'd be difficult to figure out exactly, as you're saying, all the Jewish Arabs there, but and all the Christians and everybody else. But basically, I guess the fear, the greatest fear being that Israeli Jews would be under the jurisdiction of Palestinian policemen, and they'll never stand for that. So maybe each side could have their own police force, something like that.
You know, I'm not entirely against the idea of a binational state, as long as the ultimate objective, as you know, is a one state for two people. You know, if everyone, every citizen is being judged based on his citizenship, not based on his race and his color and his ethnicity or religion, how do we get there? I think it's a subject that should be open for discussion, and I think there is a growing number of Israeli intellectuals that started really with Avi Shleiman, Ilan Pape, and these people who are now thinking with us in the right direction. And there are constantly conferences taking place in various universities around the world, really beginning to discuss the formulation. We are going beyond the stage of one state versus two states into, mm-hmm. We are not even talking about two states anymore at this point, Scott. Really, this is just something that's happening in Paris and in Washington and elsewhere, but it's really not happening at a, you know, intellectual level. We are now talking about the post one state. What does it mean in practical terms? Mm-hmm. If it's going to start as a two state, as, you know, within a transition, let's say, of 3 to 5 years to get us to where we want to be and to avoid any major disruption or clash or whatever, I don't think it's a bad idea. But again, the ultimate objective really should be one person, one vote, and people should be treated equally regardless of their background.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right, too, that this argument has made major progress here. Maybe it's much more even than I realize, but I'm certainly aware of many on the left in America, including many Jews, all different writers and people all over the spectrum on the left in America have, you know, very simply just kind of cut ties with their old idea. As you said, you used to argue for the two-state solution yourself, and certainly Mondo Weiss and those guys are leading the way as far as that goes, but they're not alone. So, yeah, I guess I'm kind of behind the times too, but so I think it's important to have this out for people who haven't heard it enough. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming back on the show, Ramsey. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Scott, for having me again. You take care.
Yep. All right, y'all, that is Ramsey Baroud, ramseybaroud.net and palestinechronicle.com. His latest book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, and you can find a lot of what he writes, not all of it, because he really writes, he writes all the time. But we run a lot of it at antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Ramsey-Baroud.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO. That was a special report featuring Ramsey Baroud on the death of the two-state solution. Coming up next is Ali Abunima, who is an author and commentator, most recently of the book One Country.
Joining us now is Ali Abunima. He is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. He's the author of a couple of books, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, which is out recently from Haymarket, and before that, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure, Mark.
I haven't had a chance to read The Battle for Justice yet, but I read One Country, and I had you on when it was published. It seems now that the idea of One Country is being discussed again, in part because of President Trump meeting Bibi Netanyahu and that coming up during a press conference. I want to get your response to that, but I want people to hear it for themselves first and kind of get what the audio sounds like.
I'm looking at two state and one state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one.
So the voice you heard in the background laughing is Netanyahu. For people, Ali, who are not familiar with this two-state, one-state idea, just very briefly explain what that even means.
Well, very simply, for many decades, the orthodoxy has been that there should be a two-state solution, which is an Israeli Jewish state and a Palestinian state. And that sounded very fair to a lot of people, including a lot of reasonable people. But it hid the reality that, you know, Israel never agreed to a real Palestinian state. And by necessity, the vast majority of Palestinians would be disenfranchised by such a solution, because Israel's imperative is to maintain a Jewish majority that was originally created through ethnic cleansing. So what a two-state solution means in practice is that the vast majority of Palestinian refugees could never go home. So for a number of years, many people, including myself, or let's say a growing number of people, have been saying, you know, the best and fairest solution is a single state in all of the territory that is now Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip. This doesn't harm Israeli Jews in any way, because they'd continue to live there with all their rights. But it restores all the rights of Palestinians, including refugees, who can now come home, because it will be a state not based on ethnicity and religion, as Israel is, but a state based on equal rights for all citizens. So that's really the one-state, two-state debate. And so it was, in some ways, counterintuitive to hear someone like Donald Trump saying, you know, I can live with either. Because for many years, the international orthodoxy has been, no, there has to be a two-state solution.
And what do you make of Netanyahu's response at the time? The laughter was, I guess, somewhat nervous, but also approving. What do we know about his position on the two-state, one-state?
Well, his position is like that of many Israelis. They don't want a two-state solution where there is anything resembling a fully sovereign, independent Palestinian state with real control over its land, its borders, its resources. And they don't want a one-state solution where everyone has equal rights. They want to have their cake and eat it. They want, in effect, the status quo, where you have right now a de facto one-state solution, but it's a one-state solution where Israel has all the control and Israeli Jews have all of the rights. So Netanyahu's kind of chuckle, I think, was sort of a nervous laugh.
And, I mean, one of the criticisms by several people on the Israeli side of the equation is that a one-state solution would mean that Israeli Jews would eventually, in the not-too-distant future, perhaps be outnumbered, and then Jews would become a minority within that single state.
Well, that's not a function of the one-state to two-state solution. That's just the reality. The reality is that today the number of Palestinians and Israeli Jews in all the territory controlled by Israel is roughly equal. Unless Israel is willing to engage in, more and much larger ethnic cleansing, it doesn't get to choose how many Palestinians are there. The choice is only what kind of regime people live under. And the choice Israel has made up until now is that they should live under an apartheid regime where Israeli Jews have all the rights and Palestinians don't have any rights. So, a one-state solution is a recognition of the reality that they are equal in number. Palestinians are likely to form a slight majority very soon if they don't already. By some estimates, they already do. And that in such a situation, everyone ought to have equal rights. It's self-evident in any other situation. The notion that, Israeli Jews must maintain control forever because they're afraid that other people will get civil rights is a really nasty and racist notion if you think about it.
And of course, absent from that podium and absent from much of the discussion generally on the international stage is any representation of the Palestinians themselves.
That's right, and we also have to be specific by what we mean about the Palestinians, because to the extent that Palestinians are ever represented, it tends to be the Palestinian Authority leadership, which I would argue is very unrepresentative of Palestinians and really doesn't have any sort of mandate. And I think there's a big split now. When you talk to these Palestinian Authority officials, they're very invested in the two-state solution because that's the only justification for the Palestinian Authority to continue to exist. And they have a self-interest because they want to be the ruling elite of this Palestinian state. But if you talk to Palestinians pretty much anywhere in the world, and in the diaspora and in Palestine, there's a great deal of openness about the one-state solution, because for Palestinians, the issue has not been sort of a fetishistic obsession with statehood and having a flag and having symbols of a state. It's been about Palestinian rights, and Palestinians can imagine their rights being fulfilled within a one-state solution.
Because at least at that point, they would have the same rights as any other citizen of that state.
Yes, I mean, they would have more rights than in a two-state solution, because they would have the right to return and live in any part of historic Palestine. The vast majority of Palestinian refugees are not from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the areas that would form the bulk of a Palestinian state, if it were even possible to have a two-state solution. But they come from areas within present-day Israel. Areas, by the way, which are largely empty. The notion that, Palestinian refugees returning would displace the vast majority of Israeli Jews is nonsense. The vast majority of the lands from which Palestinians were expelled and sent into exile and kept in exile solely because they're not Jews, the vast majority of those lands are empty and people can return to them. It's a political issue, not a geographical or resource issue.
So given the political nature of this conflict, I mean, you mentioned that Trump is breaking with orthodoxy, and that orthodoxy goes back at least as far as the Carter administration. We're talking about 30-plus years now, minimum. So how significant is this vocabulary change? Is it something that we read into Trump being misinformed, or is he flying in the face of convention deliberately? What do you make of not only his response, but what you think the prospects for a proposal or for a peaceful resolution might be without U.S. involvement. Is that even possible?
Well, here is very important to make a distinction. What Trump's statement did that we just heard is it, in a sense, opened up discussion. I mean, I've been talking about a one-state solution now on various radio programs for days since this statement. That's more discussion about a one-state solution than I've seen in years. And similarly, you know, there's relatively speaking in the mainstream media more discussion about it, although with very few Palestinian voices. Nonetheless, it's opened up the question. But so that's a good thing. But it's very important not to think that, you know, we should place any sort of hope on Trump himself or his administration. It's very hard to read Trump. I mean, you know, all of us are wondering what is really in this man's mind. Is he a fool? Is he an evil genius? Is he a puppet in the hands of, you know, quite sinister advisors like Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller and others? What is in no doubt is that some of his top advisors are very, very, very far to the right, even of Netanyahu. I mean, these are people who have been personally involved in financing settlements in the West Bank and so on. So there's nothing to give a lot of hope there. But I think that we should use this opening to push the discussion among people to make them understand that justice doesn't come from territorial separation and segregation of people, but comes from equal rights, restitution, decolonization, and a future-oriented solution that brings people together, not this language of segregation and separation that is so inherent to the two-state solution. So that's the opportunity. And also to understand that Israel and the U.S. are not going to just grant Palestinians their rights, but that there has to be continued momentum and pressure and support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is really the most effective means we have as communities, as citizens, as people all over the globe to continue to escalate that pressure.
So I've had a reading of the situation that has kind of stuck with me for a while, and I want to run it by you and tell me what you think. You mentioned that the Palestinian Authority is very much invested in the two-state solution. It's a sort of reason for existence in a way. It seems to me like the Israeli side and the Americans are also invested in a two-state solution, but for different reasons. And that is that insisting that the two-state solution is the only fair resolution while also not working towards making it happen means perpetuating the status quo indefinitely. And so I sense that there will be a lack of will on both the American and Israeli side of this equation to actually implement either a two-state or a one-state solution, because either one of those means changing the current situation from which both parties benefit significantly.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, that, you know, there's been an analysis among Israeli elites for quite some years that there is no quote-unquote solution. There's no prospect of a peace agreement. And therefore, what we have to do is conflict management, which means basically keeping a lid on any Palestinian resistance, dealing with issues as they come up, managing the diplomatic crisis and isolation that Israel finds itself in, and so on. And a key part of that is this act that Netanyahu does, where he says, oh, you know, we want peace. We would love to have peace. Let's sit down and talk about peace. But, you know, right at the beginning of this peace process now, or a generation ago, back in the early 1990s, that was the Israeli strategy. Israel, Yitzhak Shamir, the Israeli prime minister in the early 1990s when this peace process got underway, later said, you know, my strategy was just to keep talks going for 10 years and to keep building settlements in the meantime. Well, that succeeded beyond his wildest dreams, because we've had this so-called peace process since 1991. And so that's more than 25 years. And in every one of those years, Israel has been building settlements. So that, in a nutshell, is the Israeli strategy. Talk peace, build settlements.
And do you see any change in that strategy? I mean, Trump said to Netanyahu, something along the lines of, I'd appreciate it if you slowed down the settlement building a little bit. But that's not exactly strong talk.
Well, you know, it's interesting because clearly Israel had expected and calculated that Trump would actually give them a green light and say, go ahead and build settlements. The fact that he did not do so is somewhat significant. But at most, it signals a return to the policy of the Obama administration and the other administrations before it, which is to verbally oppose settlements while doing nothing to stop them in practice. So at best, Trump is sticking to the Obama policy, but it's important to remember that the Obama policy is really bad because the Obama policy is words and no action. So that's not going to change by itself, which is why, you know, it's so critical that there is real accountability in the form of international popular pressure, such as boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And that really is the only thing Israel is afraid of. That's why Israel is putting so much effort into trying to fight the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, because they understand its effect and its potential to have an even bigger effect.
Which, of course, raises the sort of historical parallel of South Africa. So before I let you go, for people who haven't heard very much about the current state of the BDS movement within the U.S., just give us a brief lay of the land. Where is the campaign now, and what has been done to push back by various institutions? Because I know some universities have pushed back against it, some companies as well. Where does it stand today, do you think?
Well, I think the best assessment comes from two staunch opponents of the BDS movement, the Anti-Defamation League and the Re'ut Institute, which is an Israeli think tank that has masterminded a lot of the efforts to thwart this movement. And in a report that they produced earlier this month that the Jewish Daily Forward reported on, they concluded that the movement has grown 20-fold since 2010, and that all of Israel's efforts to stop it have failed. So that's their assessment. And really, it's a movement that's gaining ground, gaining momentum, gaining credibility. In the past year or two, it's shown that it can make the biggest corporations in the world heed Palestinian rights, including companies like G4S, the world's biggest security company, that announced it's planning to pull out completely from Israel. Orange Mobile, one of the world's biggest telecoms companies, pulled out. Veolia, a huge French infrastructure firm, pulled out. And recently, Palestinians called for a boycott of Hyundai because of the use of Hyundai equipment for the demolition of Palestinian homes. So this is a movement that is growing in confidence to take on some of the biggest companies in the world and succeed.
Well, I'm certainly glad, as you are, that this is now one of the few silver linings of a Trump administration, that this topic is being accepted as being part of the discussion, if not necessarily being represented by Palestinian voices in the mainstream. So that's why we have you on, and I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thank you, Mark. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much. That was the voice of Vali Abunaima. He's the co-founder of Electronic Intifada, which is linked from our website, is electronicintifada.net. He's the author of two books, Battle for Justice in Palestine. That's his most recent. And before that, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. I have a link to his most recent article about the very meeting between Trump and Netanyahu that we were discussing on Electronic Intifada. Go to our website for that. Where you can also go there for a link to Catherine Ross's page. That is CatherineJRossLawProf.com. If that's a little too much to remember, you just have to remember one thing, themonitor.wordpress.com, where you'll also have at the very top the Twitter handles for both Catherine and Ali. And if you go to the top left of the page, you can learn all about the show, which goes back to 2003. And right in the middle of the page, there's a link to show you how to listen live online and how to download podcasts and listen whenever you like. The good news is that there are something like a dozen or so stations around the country, Pacifica affiliates, all of them, as far as I can tell, that play this show. The bad news is that I don't always know when and if those shows are played regularly. So if you're at one of those stations, I would like to hear from you, as several listeners have already done in the past. Send an email to themonitor@journalist.com with any comments, questions, feedback, ideas for interviews, and so on. I do read pretty much everything that hits the inbox. I don't get a chance to reply to it all, but I do read it, and I'm curious to hear what people have to say. The website, one more time before we go, themonitor.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Robert Gardner for engineering the show. Just time to leave you with a couple of news headlines that I want to kind of draw your attention to that I think are going to be big in the next couple of weeks. This tension between U.S. intelligence community and the president, which I've mentioned at the beginning, there's going to be an interesting potential appointment, an interesting potential review of the spy agencies by a New York billionaire called Steven Feinberg. Administration officials said to the New York Times on Wednesday that Feinberg's only experience with national security is his capital management firm's stake in private security companies and two gun makers. So, not quite sure how he's qualified to do this, but that's sort of run of the mill for President Trump to appoint someone who doesn't seem to know what they're doing. So it's going to be interesting to see just what sort of ripples that causes in terms of the relationship between the executive branch and the intelligence world. And I don't think that Michael Flynn will be the final fallout in that relationship. This is Mark Babawi. Take care.
The poem I've chosen to read first is titled Bicultural. I used to think that coming from two different cultures was sort of a liability. I had issues of belonging and identity. And in this poem, what I tried to do was kind of reconcile these feelings. I started to feel after I grew up that coming from two cultures, holding two cultures inside me, was actually a very uniquely enriching experience. And this poem is sort of a celebration of that. Bicultural. I am a tree with grafts, the hybrid with orange and red flowers and variegated leaves, fed with morning sunlight, watered by rains that speak a different language. No one knows the secrets I carry. They have hands that meld and mold all the stories told to me by griot from south and north. My lines are not bold or fixed anymore, though clearer, like sanded wood. My trunk, thick and textured, sways to rhythms, reaches high.
The voice of Zaina Azam, and she is the executive director of the Jerusalem Fund and its educational program, and that is the Palestine Center. She's worked in education and Middle East affairs for over 30 years. She was the director of educational outreach at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, Georgetown University. But she is our poet, and we would like to talk about all those things. Before we went on, Mike, we spoke about how the world sees Arabs as a monolith. If you're Arab, you're all one thing. How do you break that myth?
Having been involved in education for so many years and reaching out to the community and the schools, I found that the best way to deal with this monolithic view, this stereotype of Arabs and Arab society, is really to show the diversity of Arab society. If you show people for who they are, for all the different things that they do, and you start feeling the humanity, the shared humanity with them, and you realize that they're not just one thing. All Arabs are blank, any kind of grouping, you could say that about. So to me, that's the most important thing. But it is an uphill struggle in this country because there are so many stereotypes of Arabs and of Muslims, Arab Muslims, Arab Christians. There's so much misinformation and disinformation, and it's something that all of us deal with on a daily basis.
Zeina Azam, but the future has to begin sometime. So let's hear a poem.
Agreed. This is a poem kind of in the vein of stereotyping and the whole concept of Orientalism, which was coined by Edward Said. He died in 2003. Edward Said was an amazing Palestinian intellectual, writer, sort of a cultural activist. And this book that he wrote titled Orientalism is one of the most important works of the 20th century. In it, he talks about how the West reduces the East, or the Orient, to very sort of tired tropes and stereotypes. And in this poem, I wanted to recover the aspects of Arab culture that are very much used as stereotype, and I wanted to recharge them with the importance that they have to us in the East. I start the poem with an epigraph by Edward Said. This is what he wrote in 2003. My argument is that history is made by men and women, just as it can also be unmade and rewritten, so that our East, our Orient, becomes ours to possess and direct. Reclaiming the oasis. I want it back, all of it. Lithe palms that spring up from wet sand, dangling chandeliers of dates, ancient camels with humps and churning mouths, the surprise of water after horizons of dunes. I want almond-shaped eyes lined with coal, deep indigo cloth wrapping warm skin, camel hair tents with secret Persian rugs inside, frankincense burning in terracotta pots next to thick woven pillows stacked in rows awaiting visitors. I want the brass coffee pot with the crescent moon spout, fragrant coffee with cardamom filling small cups, open-mouthed. Let's drink together and toast to the health of our guests who have come from far away. I want to reclaim the noble oasis with its luminous offerings, this nurturer of language and community, the geographer of our Orient.
Let's drink together. That should be the title of your book, because that's what you're all about.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Love the list. Love the imagery. I want a cup of that coffee, too, with a cardamom. And you came to this country by virtue of your parents leaving refugees during the 1948 war, and Palestinians call that the catastrophe. So Israel was established at that time in 1948, and they immigrated from Lebanon, where you had your childhood. Take us through that itinerary. The war is in 1948, and they must leave.
Yes, my parents and my entire extended family had to flee in 1948. During the war, they fled first to Lebanon, and they left everything behind. And they kept the very iconic key to their home in Palestine. The key has become such a very important symbol of the exile, the dispossession, and the hoped-for return. And they fled to Syria, where they lived for many years. We were lucky refugees in that we did not end up in camps. My father managed to find a job eventually. And I was actually born in Syria. I was born in Homs, which is now one of the most, the hotbed of the Syrian revolution, one of the cities that's really seen so much destruction. And then when I was 2 years old, we moved to Lebanon, to Beirut. So I had my childhood in Beirut. And so
it was a beautiful place at that time, right?
It was, and it remains a beautiful place, really. It's a city on the Mediterranean, and it's just a lovely, lovely city. It has a lot of contrast. You still see the scars of war in places. At the same time, you see just beautiful vistas, and Lebanon is just a gorgeous country. So to me, that was my childhood, although my identity is very much Palestinian. My in Arabic, there's a word, hanin. Hanin means longing. That's where I feel in my heart.
Oh, longing. Zaina Azam, we're at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
And this is KBOO Portland, and that was One Land, Many Voices, multiple segments. It's 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, we have Air Cascadia, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints. And at 11, the Pacific Underground crew shares their problematic favorites, those pop culture classics that were racist and or offensive. They'll explore why we're drawn to them and the importance of media literacy. And thank you, KBOO members, for all of your generous support. For those listening who are not yet members of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm/give. And that is all coming up right after these important announcements. Keep it locked right here.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Fix It Fair, starting at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday, February 25th at Madison High School in Portland. Fix It Fairs bring people together to learn simple and effective ways to save money and be healthy at home this winter. They feature exhibits and workshops from numerous community partners throughout the day in both English and Spanish, on topics like food and nutrition, community resources, recycling, and more. Again, that's the Portland Fix It Fair on Saturday, February 25th from 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Madison High School, 2735 Northeast 82nd Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland